This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the upcoming Supreme Court case, City and County of San Francisco v. Sheehan. It involved police kicking down the door of a mentally disturbed female and shooting her 5 times at point-blank range. Police misconduct expert Michael Avery joins us to talk about the legal issues that the High Court will examine. As part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, today we're talking with David Carries from Philadelphia. David began his career at the Philadelphia Public Defender's Office in the late 1960s. Since then, he has been a leader in efforts to fight discrimination and to protect individual rights. He's now regarded as one of the nation's preeminent civil rights attorneys. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
In December 2014, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, City and County of San Francisco v. Sheehan. The facts of the case dovetail with other incidents involving excessive use of force by police. San Francisco police officers reported to a group home to transport Teresa Sheehan, who was known to be mentally ill, to a mental health facility. Instead of following department protocol for responding to mentally disturbed persons, the situation ended with police firing 6 shots at Sheehan. She suffered multiple fractures to her leg, to her left orbital wall, to her cheekbone, and endured multiple blood transfusions and surgical procedures. She miraculously survived and filed a lawsuit arguing that officers had a duty under federal law to take into consideration her mental disability when they approached her. To discuss this case, we're joined by returning guest author and civil rights lawyer Michael Avery. A renowned authority on police misconduct, Michael is the former president of the National Lawyers Guild and the National Police Accountability Project. Michael, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be with you, Heidi.
Michael, who is Teresa Sheehan, and why is the U.S. Supreme Court interested in her case?
Teresa Sheehan is a woman in her mid-50s who was living in a group home in San Francisco, a home for people with mental disabilities. She had been living there for a while. She had her own room, and she shared common space with others. And officers came to the house and ended up shooting her 5 times at point-blank range. The case raises some issues for the court on which the lower federal courts are in disagreement, and the court took the case hoping to resolve those disagreements.
Now, we hear about shootings, at least in New York City, where police respond to an emotionally disturbed person. They fear for their lives, or so they say. But this happened, as you say, in a home where I assume there would be attending experts on dealing with persons like this. How did the police come to use lethal force in this protected environment?
Well, there were no experts actually in the home, although there was a social worker there. The police came because the social worker had been concerned about Ms. Sheehan, wanted to send her to a hospital for 72 hours for evaluation, and requested the assistance of the police in transporting her to the hospital. Ms. Sheehan, on the other hand, did not want to be taken to the hospital, did not want the social worker in her room, did not want the police in her room. She just wanted to be left alone. And in the course of asserting her right to be left alone, she threatened the police and the social worker with a knife. The police then ended up breaking through her door, forcing open her door, and when she was standing there with the knife, they tried to pepper spray her. That didn't have much effect on her, and so they shot her 5 times at point-blank range.
Now, I understand, despite that shooting, that she survived, albeit with several serious injuries.
Miraculously, she survived, although now she's permanently disabled and disfigured. One of the bullets entered the left side of her temple. shattered her eye socket and then exited through her mouth, causing serious injuries to her jaw as well.
Before we talk about her claims before the Supreme Court, I wanted to get into the issue of how officers across the country are trained when they encounter persons who either have a mental illness or are acting in a way that could be considered strange.
That's really the most interesting thing about this case. From my point of view, officers encounter people with mental disabilities extremely frequently. In large cities and towns in the United States, it's estimated that one out of every 15 people that the police interact with has some form of mental illness. So because these incidents are so common, I mean, officers are much more likely to run into a mentally ill person than they are to have to arrest a bank robber, for example. Because these incidents are so common, officers receive training on how to handle them. And that training is pretty much the same all across the United States. Officers are trained to try to defuse the incident, not to threaten the person, to ask open-ended questions, to listen to what the person has to say, try to establish some rapport with the person, respect the person's space and not crowd the person, and at the same time, to allow the incident to go on as long as it has to in order to have a peaceful resolution. Everybody agrees that when officers act with haste and try to resolve these situations as rapidly as possible, that seriously increases the risk of a violent outcome.
It's interesting, a statistic about the number of contacts with persons with mental illness and police officers. I read that there's an estimated 7% of the contacts that police have are with people who they should be trained to deal with in the fashion you describe. That amounts to, I think, one out of every 15 persons that police interact with. That's an extraordinarily high number.
It is a high number. This is all a result of national policies in the 90s to deinstitutionalize many mentally ill people and to take them out of hospitals and return them to society. The problem is the country never invested the amount of money and resources in outpatient care that would have been required to give these people some assistance outside the hospital. So many of them are just wandering the streets or living alone, and from time to time they act out and they get into some kind of confrontation with the police. And the police, instead of treating them like mentally ill people, treat them like criminals, which leads to disastrous outcomes.
Teresa's case is going before the Supreme Court this spring. Who's representing her?
Teresa is currently being represented by John Burris and Ben Niesenbaum from San Francisco, California, from Oakland to be more precise. And then Leonard Feldman is going to argue the case in the United States Supreme Court.
And I understand that you're consulting or helping with some of the briefing, given your expertise or research and articles that you've printed in the past on this subject?
Yes, several years ago I wrote an article called Unreasonable Seizures of Unreasonable People, making the point that officers ought to be held to a standard that requires them to follow their own training. And so when I saw this case was in the court, I volunteered to provide some assistance to the lawyers in connection with the brief they were writing.
Now, we want to talk about the specific claims, but before we do, Michael, it dawns on me that recently we've heard a lot across the country about police encounters with individuals that have resulted in the use of lethal force. And amazingly, there is no federal requirement that police departments maintain statistics of fatalities in such encounters. I would imagine that it might be difficult to extract specific statistics on the use of force against persons with mental disabilities.
It's very difficult, but we know that there are a lot of these cases because many of them end up in litigation, and there are dozens, if not more, reported cases in which the police have shot and killed somebody who was mentally ill.
So let's talk about the claims in Teresa's case. The lawyers are asserting that there's an unreasonable search and seizure.
That's correct. There are two claims in the case. One is a claim under the Fourth Amendment, which is the part of the Bill of Rights that says government cannot make unreasonable searches of our homes or seizures of our person. And the other is a claim under the Americans with Disabilities Act. There's a provision of the ADA, as it's called, Americans with Disabilities Act, that says that when the local governments provide services to people, they cannot discriminate against them because they are disabled. So in this case, Teresa Sheehan's lawyers are arguing two things. One is that when the police came to her home to take her to the hospital, in effect, they discriminated against her on the basis of her disability by not following their training and by not making the accommodations that they were trained to make for a mentally ill person. And then secondly, the argument is when they forced open the door to her apartment and entered and then used deadly force against her, they were not behaving reasonably. And that, again, is based on the same idea that it would have been reasonable to follow their training, but frankly, they just threw their training out the window.
Now, let's start with that claim, because I'm a little more familiar with searches and seizures. Do the term that our listeners may or may not know, exigent circumstances, apply in this? In other words, if the officers reasonably believed that a person was perhaps in danger and might harm herself in this situation, they could have broken down the door, for example, without a search warrant.
Well, yes, if there are exigent circumstances that suggest either there's a risk to third persons, a member of the public or somebody else, or that the person might be a danger to themselves, then the police are allowed to enter an apartment or a home without a warrant. But the important point to remember here is, even if the police have a warrant, or even if they have exigent circumstances, the Fourth Amendment requires that any entry into a home be reasonable. The Supreme Court has over and over again said that the linchpin of the Fourth Amendment protection is reasonableness. And that's really what Teresa Sheehan's lawyers are arguing here, that the entry wasn't reasonable in the first place because there was no reason to believe anybody was in danger, and secondly, because the way they entered and at the time they entered was most likely to lead to a violent outcome.
And they knew no one else would be harmed because they saw that Teresa was alone in her room.
Yes, they had gone into the room once. It's just a small room, about 11 by 14 or something like that. They had been in the room. The social worker had been in the room. They knew no one else was in the room. And they also knew that there was only one entrance and exit to the room, which was the door that they were standing in front of. So when she threatened them and ordered them out of her room and they left and then she closed the door behind them, what they should have done was to get somebody from a critical incident team, and they have these critical incident teams in San Francisco, somebody trained to deal with a mentally ill person. They should have had somebody from a critical incident team come out and talk Ms. Sheehan down and find out what was bothering her and see if there was a way they could find out what was on her mind that would help them resolve this situation peacefully. But instead of doing that, they just forced the door open and burst into her room where they knew they would find her standing there with a knife.
Michael, how difficult will it be to prevail on this specific search and seizure claim?
In the United States Supreme Court?
Yes.
Well, we know that the court has been very conservative on these law enforcement cases. The court gives officers a wide berth in which they can make mistakes about what they do. And so these claims are never easy. But on the other hand, there are some issues in this case that make it a very strong claim, particularly the issue of the training. These officers had been trained that mentally ill people frequently will threaten you, and frequently will demand to be left alone, which is precisely what Ms. Sheehan did. They should have known that proceeding in the way they were proceeding would lead to a violent outcome, and they should have waited. And that's a very strong argument, and I don't think it's asking too much to ask the Supreme Court to insist that officers follow their own training.
In fact, as I understand it, the San Francisco Police Department training materials actually advise officers of telltale signs of mental illness that may include making, quote, direct threats, and specifically, quote, begging to be left alone. That's exactly what Teresa was asking for.
That's right, and that's in their training materials. They had been trained on that. That shouldn't have come as a surprise to them. And what happens if you treat somebody exhibiting those kind of symptoms as a criminal, you treat them completely in the opposite way that's likely to lead to a satisfactory outcome. You know, most criminals, interestingly enough, are rational. So if they're confronted with a police officer with weapons, or if they're confronted with superior force, they'll recognize at some point that they have to give in to that. But a person who's suffering from delusions or disorganized thinking won't necessarily perceive that. And so when the officers are shouting orders and threats to such a person, it just makes the situation worse.
Now, let's talk about the ADA claim that Teresa's lawyers are also bringing in this case. I understand that claims under the ADA and the Civil Rights Act are often difficult to win because there exist several technical defenses that government officials can claim. How would that play out in this case?
Well, in this case, the ADA claim is against the city of San Francisco, whereas the Fourth Amendment claim is against the individual officers. So the city of San Francisco has argued that Teresa Sheehan was not a person who was qualified to receive the benefits of the ADA because she was dangerous. The Department of Justice had drafted some guidelines for enforcing the ADA, and those guidelines said that in order to be eligible to receive government benefits, a person can't pose a danger to the public. That's a funny argument to make in this case, because the very reason the officers were at Teresa Sheehan's apartment was because of her disability, and the reason they thought she was dangerous was also because of her disability. So it seems pretty anomalous to say that the city is going to provide her with services which those services were being forced upon her, and then to say she's disqualified from receiving them because she's dangerous.
Now, Michael, I understand that the American Civil Liberties Union is filing an amicus or friend of the court brief in this case. What are they focusing on in that brief?
Yes, they're focused on this ADA issue in their brief, because this is an issue that has divided some of the lower federal courts, and it's very important to the disability community that the Supreme Court make a ruling in this case that would require police officers to afford accommodations to mentally ill people who are, you know, that the police are in the process of taking into custody for one reason or another. There's another amicus brief on behalf of Ms. Sheehan's side of the case that's been filed by the National Police Accountability Project, which is a project of the National Lawyers Guild. And the focus of that brief is on the Fourth Amendment issue. And that's a brief that goes into considerable detail about the type of training that police officers in California in particular get with regard to interactions with mentally ill people.
We have a few minutes left, Michael, and because of your expertise in police misconduct, civil rights, Fourth Amendment search and seizure law, I'm curious about your take on the current state of the Supreme Court. You've alluded to the fact that they tend to come down on the side of law enforcement, but in the context of the mass movements that we've seen across the country in light of the failure to indict in Ferguson, Missouri, the Eric Garner case in New York, and I think a heightened awareness of disparities in how officers are held accountable for failure to enforce, say, in New York, an anti-chokehold policy. Do you see any of these sort of movements in the street and increased media coverage as having an impact on the thrust of the court?
Well, you know, with regard to many issues that are important to the public, the Supreme Court is not immune to public thinking. Look at the gay marriage issue, for example, where it seems pretty clear at this point that the court is going to uphold the right of homosexuals to marry same-gender people. Same has been true of other issues over the years. So I'm hoping that the court will understand that there's increasing concern in the country about whether or not police officers are going to be held accountable to the law themselves. It's very difficult to hold officers accountable. The grand jury system, as we've seen recently, is a difficult route to take. But in the past, it's been civil suits like Ms. Sheehan's, where citizens have an opportunity to present the case to a jury of their peers and ask people in their own community, sitting as jurors, to hold officers accountable. That's the one part of the system that's worked well in the past. The problem is that the Supreme Court over the years has both narrowed the scope of constitutional rights, narrowed the definition of what amounts to a constitutional violation, and provided various technical defenses to police officers that allow them to escape from accountability.
Now,
so I'm hoping maybe in this current climate, the court will want to do something to show that the Constitution has meaning, that federal statutes like the ADA have meaning, and that police officers are obliged to go along with them, particularly when their own training requires them to do so.
You'd hope so. I neglected to ask you, Michael, about the fact that after Teresa was physically disabled and disfigured by the police actions, the local prosecutor actually charged her with two counts of assault with a deadly weapon, as well as counts of assault on a police officer with a deadly weapon and making criminal threats against personnel at the facility she was in. That case went to trial in 2008, and the jury was unable to reach a unanimous verdict on the assault counts and found her not guilty on the criminal threats. And then the prosecutor announced the city wasn't going to retry her. How common is that, to bring charges against the person harmed?
Well, it's actually very common, particularly where the police have made allegations that the person had a weapon of some kind. The prosecutors work with the police every day. Prosecutors are going to back up the police 99 times out of 100. That's one of the reasons that you didn't get a good result from the grand jury in Ferguson, because the local prosecutor was basically acting like the defense lawyer for the police officer instead of like the prosecuting attorney. So it's not uncommon. It's also not uncommon for police officers not to be disciplined internally in connection with these incidents. So that's why I put so much emphasis on civil lawsuits against the police, because it really is, you know, the civil jury is a democratic institution. And it's people in the community sitting as jurors enforcing the law. And I think that is one way to get police accountability.
Well said, and I agree with you on that. In our remaining couple of minutes, Michael, I wanted to ask you your opinion on the role that police unions have played and continue to play across the country, as it were, sometimes interfering with the course of justice.
Well, you know, I'm what we used to call, before we became a little more gender conscious, I'm a union man, so I'm in favor of unions. On the other hand, the police unions have played a very regressive role in society. They have become really a political institution that takes a law and order perspective toward enforcing the law, not a compassionate perspective and not one that at all requires accountability for the officers themselves. So there's a big difference between a police union, which is getting involved in matters of use of excessive force and issues of that sort, and a union in a factory or an office or any other workplace where workers are primarily concerned about their compensation and their benefits and things of that sort. So even though I'm strongly pro-union, I have to say that the police unions do not play a good role in society, and you've recently seen that in New York in spades, where they've challenged the mayor and refused to enforce the law and just really gone completely ballistic in their approach.
In fact, a few weeks ago, we had your friend and colleague Jonathan Moore on to talk about his representation in the Eric Garner case and about issues such as police unions. And he mentioned that here in New York, Patrick Lynch, the head of our Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, as a white officer, isn't really representative of the more diverse police department that we have here, and kind of harkens back to the historic police department that was predominantly white. But I certainly think, at least in New York, when a kind of showdown happened between Mayor de Blasio and the union, it was heartening to have public opinion polls express dissatisfaction with the way the police, you know, turned their back on the mayor at the officers' funerals and came out sort of with their own campaign against de Blasio.
Well, yes. I mean, if police unions were coming out and saying we should be paid more, we should get better training, there should be more services available to officers who were suffering from alcoholism or stress or other problems, I would support those demands of police unions 100%. But those are different than the demands that some of the police unions make, which just have to do with avoiding accountability for their own actions.
Michael, we look forward to hearing what happens in this case. So the Supreme Court is considering it. Will there be oral arguments in a month or two?
Oral argument is scheduled for March 23rd.
All right. Well, if people are interested in reading more about this, is there a resource for them, a website?
I expect that the case will get a fair amount of press when it is argued in the court.
Exactly. And the ACLU amicus brief will probably be up on their website.
No doubt.
And the Police Accountability Project.
Yes, the NPAP brief will be up on our website.
Great. Michael, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Pleasure is mine.
All right. We'll stay in touch.
All right.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, today we're talking with David Carries from Philadelphia. David began his career at the Philadelphia Public Defender's Office in the late 1960s. Since then, he has been a leader in efforts to fight discrimination and to protect individual rights. He's now regarded as one of the nation's preeminent civil rights attorneys. David is a professor at Temple University Law School, where he teaches civil rights and constitutional law. He has written several books, including the most recent Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer, which we'll discuss today.
Hello, David, and welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, Michael.
We're here to interview and talk to David about his latest book, Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. And I just want to say a personal thing. I've known David forever, actually. We went to Cuba in 1973 together. David still has the hidden videotapes of our trip. But when I picked up the book, I thought, oh, another book about law. But of course, it's one of the most, David's one of the most prominent civil liberties lawyer in the country, and certainly around the Northeast in Philadelphia, well known. And when I picked up the book, I actually couldn't put it down. So I really want to recommend it because it's a book of stories, really, of some remarkable cases and David's role in them that really documents really the history of this country over the last 40 years. So I highly recommend it. So thank you for doing it, David.
Thank you, Mike.
It's a book of stories, but I think equally important, it's a book about themes and what we call people's lawyering. The first chapter in the book talks about Mr. Giles and his case, which we thought exemplified the dual importance of sort of taking a case to the streets as well as to the courts. Although in this case, it was mostly about a campaign that you waged on behalf of a man who'd escaped from prison and been living a good life, a productive life in Philadelphia. We were interested to know how you knew how to organize with the editorials and the educational campaign. Did that just come instinctively?
Well, I really didn't know, and I tried to show that as honestly as I could in the book, because I really just went from idea to idea, and at some point it did occur to me that what I was organizing was more a political campaign than anything else. The guy had escaped from the Georgia Chain Gang 25 years earlier, about when I was born. I was in my first 2 weeks in the public defender office, and I really didn't know much of anything.
That's what I couldn't get over, David. You were just, we'd gone to law school. You were maybe a year ahead of me or so. But you didn't know anything. You just got out of law school a year or so before.
Yeah, and I didn't even know enough to know how little I knew. You know?
That's the best thing, maybe, David. But go ahead and continue on the story. You were working at the public defenders in Philadelphia.
And this woman who, with this gravelly but resonant sort of voice that immediately struck me as being interviewed by my office mate. I'm not in the bar yet, you know, I'm barely able to do anything. And so I started listening, and she's very upset. She's gesturing her arms and crying, and the story comes out that her husband was taken in the night before for nothing that amounted to anything, but he got fingerprinted. Fingerprint showed he was this fellow who escaped from a Georgia chain gang, convicted of murder. The authorities in Georgia wanted him back, and the experienced lawyer my office mate explained that there really wasn't anything the office could do or any lawyer could do, because for an extradition, all the state of Georgia had to show was that a crime was committed and that he was the person either charged or, in this case, actually convicted of committing it. And any other complaints about the trial or, for instance, was an all-white jury, he really had no lawyer. It was a terrible kind of injustice. But all of that would be raised in Georgia when you go back. So I just had this urge to intervene, and to a large extent, I think the book is about my dealing with that urge or not in various situations. So I didn't know what I was going to do, but I asked, could I go interview him and look into it? And he was a little perturbed, which I certainly didn't blame him for, because he was experienced and I knew absolutely nothing. Anyway, as it turns out, I start researching it, and I did find that there was this one opening, which was, as a routine process, all extraditions require that the governor of the state in which the person's picked up sign what's called the extradition warrant. And without the governor's signature on that warrant, the whole thing stops. So I could ask the governor, although no governor in Pennsylvania history had ever done this or even been open to this as far as I knew, I could ask him not to sign and ask for a hearing. And then basically it became a question, how do I influence this recently elected conservative Republican governor? And my colleagues in the public defender office are saying, you know, this is certainly a noble cause, but you're spending an awful lot of time doing something that looks unwinnable. And I had no good answer. I just kept doing it. And eventually I got the major stroke of luck, which was that the Republican district attorney of Philadelphia, Arlen Specter, of course, who's now a well-known senator, had been elected with the support of only one union, and that was the construction union that this man, James Giles, the escapee from the chain gang, had worked for 25 years.
Isn't that incredible? I mean, it is just a piece of luck, David, but on the other hand, you know, what I think, to me, what that story illustrates is, in some way, you make your own luck. You push and push and push, and at some point, whether it was that particular thing that opened up, but something opened up, and I think that's what's really significant here.
It is, and the reality is you don't know. You could make a good case, and it was made to me many times, that I could spend the equivalent time on other injustices. It's not like this was the only thing going on, right?
Right.
But this one fell into my lap. I was just really moved by it, particularly when I went up and talked to him. It turned out it was a fight between two men. It was basically self-defense. He had killed another black man. He was also black. In Georgia, if he'd have killed a white man, he'd have been executed. Since it was another black man and it was a fight, he got life on the chain gang. But so eventually I went to the union, got the union to go to Arlen Specter. I went to Specter, got the probation department to write up a report so Specter would feel he's insulated from criticism, the probation department being responsible for saying, you know, this man is no danger to anyone. And Specter then wrote a letter to the governor, and the governor's office gave me a hearing, and we had petitions, and Mrs. Giles, who was a gospel singer, sang in most every black church in the city, and we won.
Oh, it's remarkable. It reads like a good detective story. I thought I was going to pick up this book and skim through it, and then boom.
David, we also wanted to talk about the well-known Camden 28 draft board case.
Okay.
The FBI set up a sting of Catholic anti-war activists.
You like the ones that seemed hopeless.
Right. Always.
They were caught in the act of basically breaking into the Camden, New Jersey draft board and tearing up and destroying all of the files in every file cabinet in the office.
These were draft files, is that right?
Yes. They started with the 1A, the ones that would be drafted first.
What year was this, David?
Action, 1971.
They started with 1As, right?
Yeah, and then they got to every classification. Now, it turns out that the FBI had an informant in the group who the FBI was paying on an hourly rate to inform on them, and he basically supplied the strategies and the materials necessary to actually make the action happen. But since the FBI knew all about it, it was their option when or whether to bust these people, and they just sat around. There was over 100 FBI agents. And waited until they had destroyed every piece of paper in the office. Then they charge in and arrest everyone.
What was it like dealing with a case that involved the FBI in terms of your strategy and approach?
See, I was still a young lawyer. I just started our firm. We were one of a number of firms really dedicated to civil rights and representation of progressive groups, and we were kind of networked among National Lawyers Guild members with the history of that organization going way back, allied with a lot of civil rights groups, the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee, the Center for Constitutional Rights. Right near the beginning, I got approached to do this case, and my first reaction, which is also in the book, was that it was because I came cheap, was the primary factor. But I did say to them right away, this was a Catholic left action, and so many of them were priests, and a lot of them did this as a moral matter, and were quite prepared to go to jail. A number of Father Michael Doyle has become a very good friend, an amazing priest in Camden, which is just one of the poorest inner city communities in the country. He's still there, standing up for poor people. And he basically said in one of the early meetings, when your government is napalming children, the place you should be is in jail. And so he was prepared to go. They were all kind of prepared to go. And I said, okay, I'll do this case. We'll try to argue that what they did was justified because of the war. That had really never succeeded in any of the anti-war cases. But
the necessity defense?
Yeah, and jury nullification.
Right.
But I said, I'm going to be looking for ways to win this as well, and got their assent. That was what really the basis on which I came in. And I was always interested in this guy that we knew was the informant, Bob Hardy. And what happened was, through Father Doyle, we strategized the way to start talking to Hardy, the informant, and eventually meeting with him. And, of course, we're worried that in those days, you know, people who had cooperated with the anti-FBI side of things had strange ways of bad things happening to them. And so we were worried about that. We had to keep it incredibly secret. And met with him several times and finally got him to do an affidavit saying that the FBI had basically manufactured this crime, that it never would have happened but for the FBI inserting Hardy in to overcome all of the obstacles. And there were over 300 draft board raids during the Vietnam War. It was a much more prevalent thing than is widely understood. But this one was different in the sense that it required a burglary of the fifth floor of an urban office building. Most all of the others were suburban or even rural draft boards, and people would wait in the men's room, you know, after closing hours, and then come out and raid the board, things like that. Anyway, he did this affidavit that said they made it happen, and the orders came from the Western White House, which was Nixon's California headquarters in San Clemente. I filed the affidavit, and it was front page in the New York Times.
Let me ask you something about... Yes. About this case, because I'm trying to recall if it's the same case that I remember when I was a young lawyer as well. Was everybody arrested actually in the draft board?
No. Some were arrested around the country. They had played some role but weren't there at that time. It was rather than the sort of sophisticated, dangerous conspiracy that J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, and John Mitchell, the attorney general, announced at the arrest. It was really a rather loose group. People came and went, and, you know, they'd come in and help and be told, do this, do that, and then they'd go home. So people were arrested in New York City.
I asked that because of New York City, because at the time, I just graduated law school maybe that year, and I was, or the year after.
I only graduated a year before.
I know. So my wife was working, Margie Ratner was working up at Legal Services on 116th Street, and the FBI came into her office. And her legal assistant was one of the Catholic people who apparently was involved and got arrested right in front of her and handcuffed right in front of her for the Camden 28 case. But I'm trying to remember his name, but I thought you might. But anyway, so she came home with this story about this guy who was her legal assistant.
Several were arrested that way. And at the trial, we used both defenses. The defendants spoke for themselves incredibly effectively. And the judge allowed an unusual arrangement where the lawyers were co-counsel with the defendants themselves, so that on any question, you know, an evidence question or a motion, whatever it was, all of the defendants, actually 17, went on trial initially. They severed some of them. Three lawyers, myself and two other lawyers, also part of this network of progressive lawyers, mainly through the Guild. We knew each other, and all 17 of them and three of us would speak on any question, and opening and closing arguments as well. So it was not easy, and I go over that in the book. Relations among the defense were not easy. Some defendants preferred one defense over the other, and that had to be worked out, but it came across incredibly effectively in court, and to my shock, there was a complete acquittal.
It's amazing. Now, there's a movie about this case, is that right?
Yeah, it's called the Camden 28. It's quite well done by a fellow named Anthony Giacchino.
Yeah, it's supposed to be fabulous. And then, and this is the last question on this case, then we'll go to the next one, but some of the children of the people involved in Camden 28 were then arrested for, other kinds of activities a few years ago, as I recall. Is that right? Do you recall that?
That's right, definitely, yes. Involving actions related to Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's right. I think it was in New York State somewhere, but...
David, we also found interesting the case of the fireman who was beaten by a police officer. You mentioned that this was a different kind of case for you when you got this.
Yes. My partner, Dave Rudofsky, and I were, both of us had our experience really in criminal law. We created the civil rights firm. It still goes on today. And we wanted to do civil rights law, and these would be mainly civil cases. And one of the big questions was whether we could succeed in police misconduct cases, because Philadelphia was known really, I guess, as much for Frank Rizzo and police brutality as for cheesesteaks in those years. And this was a major issue, but the feeling among a lot of people, among progressives and progressive lawyers, was that probably couldn't get a Philadelphia jury to rule against the police, that the sentiment was just too strongly in their favor. So the first case I did was for our office was about these two firemen. They had basically gotten Joe Rizzo, Frank's brother, who he made fire commissioner, very upset with them, and he had fired them, and one of them was beaten by the officer they complained against in a coma. And so this case went to trial. They didn't really make any settlement offer. And so here I am doing my first civil jury trial in federal court. The press is on it every day.
Amazing.
Yeah. And I'm again, you know, I'm...
Makes me nervous to even hear the story, David.
Well, I'm not 30 yet.
I know.
You know, all this is, all the cases you've done so far were before I was 30. And I was, you know, we can talk about that if you want. I was as shocked as anyone. I started out in engineering school. I did not have an activist or particularly progressive background. And here I find myself, you know, a movement lawyer in the midst of all this stuff. Anyway, Vince Marvesi, one of the firemen, testified first about how he was hit in with a blackjack by this police officer in the police station, and he goes into a coma, and he's praying, you know, is he ever going to see his children? And the jurors started crying, several of them.
And so, in fact, the Daily News had a first-page headline that said, Ex-fireman prayed when beaten by cop.
Yes. Yes.
That's in the book.
Banner headline. When they do that on our Daily News, there's no room for text. It's the letters are so big, it covers the whole front page. So things were going, from my perspective, very well. Vince was a great witness. And all of a sudden, Frank Rizzo's city solicitor, a guy named Sheldon Albert, who was seen as a, you know, I said in the book, kind of, he was to law as Rizzo was to law enforcement. I mean, he was a very aggressive, not particularly skilled lawyer, and seemed to polarize unnecessarily, right, instead of trying to work things out. Anyway, he comes down and asks the judge, this is the morning before Joe Rizzo is about to testify, and among other things, I'm ready to cross-examine about him banning the fireman from wearing anything other than white underwear. You know, you couldn't wear like a pale blue or a plaid. You know, you'd be in deep trouble in that department. Very authoritarian guy. He comes down and asks the judge, can he take me to breakfast? So we can talk about a possible settlement, which, of course, they weren't interested in earlier. And I picked a number. We had asked for $50,000, and this is $1971 dollars again. I don't know what the equivalent is, but a good middle-class income in those days was $10,000. So 50 was like, you know, five years of income for the two of them. So each would get 2.5 years of income, essentially, and I would have gotten 25% of that. So he's saying, well, you know, we've decided that we've changed our mind. We'll give you the $50,000 you asked for. So I said, well, you know, things have changed, and I think the appropriate figure is $200,000. He was somewhat livid, and he kept trying to get me off it. So I'm very inexperienced, again, at you know, dealing with this money question and damages. But my strategy was to stick to the 200, see what happened. He said, it was a one-time offer, but I thought I could easily revive it. But it was some risk, and I talked to the clients about that. Anyway, he kept saying, no, but he's coming up, 75, 100, 125. And finally, we go back into court, and I'm saying, no. And he makes one more phone call and comes up with $200,000.
David, we could listen to you for hours. These stories, your cases, your strategies are just an example for young lawyers practicing today. Most of the stories that you recount in your book go back a few decades, but one of the more recent challenges you brought related to gun manufacturers, and I remember reading about this in the law journals. Can you briefly summarize your theories on that?
Yeah, I was asked to be part of a task force that Mayor Rendell, now the governor here, set up on youth and guns. It's actually the leading force was a good friend of mine here named Mike DiBerardinis, and he was a recreation commissioner. Anyway, we started trying to figure out what, if anything, could be done about violence, guns, and particularly among poor young men. And so we had people from the ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. We brought in some of the leading social science and public health people, and we started learning about the problem. And right away, I realized all my assumptions were wrong. I thought guns, well, used in crime, were usually stolen. Well, that turns out to be a very rare thing. The more I thought about it, I began focusing on the marketing of handguns, the ways in which the gun companies knowingly market guns such that they so easily are available on urban streets and, of course, make some money in doing that. I then started viewing it also as essentially a public health and a marketing problem, which led me to a tort that hadn't really been used, public nuisance. And so I came up with a theory that didn't require any law reform. This was the 90s. This was hardly the age of progressive law reform having much chance. The virtue, or one of the big virtues of my theory, was that it didn't require any change in the law, just application of principles that go back in common law hundreds of years. The normal plaintiff in such a suit is a city or a government that's trying to protect its people from a public health danger. And the public health danger was the easy availability of handguns for criminals and for youth who weren't legally supposed to have them. So I saw all of a sudden a really good suit in this, and I proposed it to Ed Rendell, and he was really excited. He was a prosecutor and really had a pretty keen sense, even before I started, about the terrible role that handguns are playing. But politically, it became difficult, and eventually he told me to pursue the suit. He hired me as counsel for the city of Philadelphia, but it became clear that he wasn't going to bring the suit. So, and we were on Nightline, we were all over around this suit, and no suit had even been brought yet. So I withdrew as counsel and for Philadelphia and released, consistent with my obligations of attorney-client, released everything I could make public about the theory, and before you knew it, 40 cities brought the suit throughout the country, many with Republican mayors.
And that was by the year 2000.
Yeah. The first suits were brought in 98. We were doing well. For instance, we did better in the early stages, the motions to dismiss, than the state attorney general tobacco suits had done at a similar stage. They had been regularly rejected. We were running about half and half. We were winning about half of the motions to dismiss. Then the NRA and the gun manufacturers went to the legislatures and got first some state statutes granting immunity to the gun industry. And then finally Congress in 2005 in direct response to my suits. Now, I suppose this is a good testament on how good the theory was, but it didn't feel good at the time. Congress passed an immunity that extends to these suits and almost all civil suits that could be brought against gun manufacturers. For instance, gun manufacturers now can create a public nuisance, but no other company or industry or individuals are allowed to do so. They created this huge exception to the usual rules that apply to everybody else, and that ended the lawsuit. Theory, too, has gone on.
It's, the public nuisance theory.
Yeah, my theory is being used in the lead paint cases, all sorts of claims now where companies are charged with endangering the public.
Well, David, this has been great, and I want to recommend again the book Philadelphia Freedom, Memoir of a Civil Rights Lawyer. It is compelling. You can't put it down, and it gives you a real window on the last 40 years, not just in Philadelphia, but in this country, and really what difference lawyers and people's movement can make around winning important social and political issues. So thank you again, David.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.